Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Welcome to Interchange. My name is Ashley Beeman. Tonight, Interchange embarks in a new direction. For the first time in the long history of the show, we are going to offer three segments with three distinct stories. Reporter Aziza Stewart speaks with Bobby Booz about sustainable farming. Later, Dr. Irvin Laszlo talks about quantum consciousness and the mind prophecy. In our first segment, we talk with two Hoosiers about their work in the pro-life movement.
Good afternoon. My name is William Morse, and I'm here in the WFHB studios with Marion Leahy and Tom McBroom. Marion and Tom are pro-life supporters, and they've come here today to share their views on the very controversial questions of pro-life and pro-choice. Marion, Tom, it's good to have you here with us.
It's great to be here.
As you know, we had Betty Cockrum on Interchange last week, and she talked about Planned Parenthood's reaction to the recent federal court decision to enjoin the state of Indiana from blocking Medicaid funding to abortion providers. And in the spirit of Interchange, it's good for our listeners to hear both sides of the issue. As we did with Betty, let's start with the June 24th federal court decision. What are your thoughts about it? Tom?
Well, thank you, William. And first of all, thank you for inviting me to beautiful Bloomington, Indiana. It's always great to come down here and spend some time with all the fine folks here. But my feeling on it is I'm very much a supporter of cutting funding, not because so much I'm a pro-life supporter, but if you look on CNN today on their website, the number one concern is debt. And we have 9 licensed abortion clinics in Indiana. 3 of them are from the Planned Parenthood abortion chain, and they're the only ones getting our tax money. Obviously, the other 6 are thriving from it. So from a business standpoint, I'm for all cutting all my tax money from abortion, whether from a state level or a national level.
I'm all for it, mainly because I am concerned about women's health. And, you know, Planned Parenthood, they talk about women's health, but they're providing 52% of the abortions in Indiana, and abortion is associated with a lot of health problems with women. Study after study has shown that it's linked to, you know, the controversy is breast cancer, but it's also linked to premature birth, miscarriage, tubal pregnancies, definitely depression, anxiety, all kinds. There's a whole plethora of symptoms with post-abortion syndrome, and that's a further burden on Medicaid and a burden basically on our economy. If women and even men are affected by abortion in a negative way, it's going to have a negative effect on America, on the economy, and on the family.
Well, your answers give us some idea of your personal positions. Tell us what it means, each of you, please. What does it mean to be pro-life?
Well, to me, pro-life, If you're talking about abortion and reproductive rights of women, to be pro-life is to be pro-woman. It's to be pro-women's health. It's to be pro-family. It's to be pro-child. But pro-life is not just abortion. Pro-life has a lot of other issues. Tom, did you want to address some of that?
I guess there's a lot of other pro-life issues that we can talk about, like assisted suicide, euthanasia, capital punishment. These are all life issues that we're concerned about. Even feeding the hungry or giving blood to people is a pro-life issue, really, when you think about it.
But before we move on to that and those issues, which we've sort of talked about a little bit before we got on the air, when we talk about people who are pro-choice, and when we say what does pro-life mean, well, for a person who's pro-choice, it would mean that pro-life people, there's no choice. Right, they don't give a woman the right to choose. And what does pro-life stand for? This is what I'm trying to ask you. How did you become pro-life, and what does it mean to you?
I guess the how I became pro-life is, to be real honest with you, I was pro-choice. I couldn't see why, if a woman was raped or if there were some health issues, why she couldn't choose abortion. And what happened to me is I went through one of those life-changing events in my life, and I was asked to be a youth minister at a church I recently joined. And as God would have it, he's got a sense of humor, the first subject I had to teach was abortion. And what I found out is only 1% of abortions occur because of rape or incest. Also, 6% of abortions are potential health problems with the mother or the child. And actually, 93% of those abortions are just unwanted children or post-birth control type methods. And if you look at the numbers in our country, the number of abortions a year are over 1 million. The number of abortions a day are 3,700. And if we look at the troops that were killed in Iraq, in 2 days, we've already surpassed how many American casualties we had in Iraq. There's an abortion about every 24 seconds.
Well, excuse me, Tom. So you're saying in the last 2 days, there have been over 4,200 abortions?
There's been over, actually, 7,400 abortions.
Okay.
So who's having abortions? 52% of the women of abortions are younger than age 25, college age. Women aged 20 to 24 obtain 32% of all abortions. Teenagers obtain 20%, and girls under 15 account for 1.2%. So to say it's just for poverty people is kind of twisting who's really having most of the abortions in our country. And when I started realizing that, I started attending more informational sessions on abortion, and I started actually going to abortion clinics to pray and fast. And I quickly learned that we were just throwing away millions of lives. In fact, since 1973, we've killed over 53 American citizens to abortion.
So, Tom, is it safe to say that the basis of your pro-life stance is in your spiritual life?
It's very safe to say that because, again, I kind of went through a life where I spent a third of my life brought up as a Christian. I spent a third of my life, if you will, a prodigal son, and the last third I converted to Catholicism. And Catholics are very opposed to abortion, although 27% of Catholic women do account for their abortions. But I just feel it's a cause I have to speak up for children, for the woman in the womb's right, or the man in the womb's right. I cannot worry about other women that, you know, I even joke to some of my pro-life friends that I'm still pro-choice because I know the choice happens before the baby's conceived. It's not after, oops, we have a baby, what do we do? At that point, you should know your responsibility. And that's some of the problem in our country, especially with fatherhood, is people know their rights, but with rights comes responsibility.
I would say the reason why I became pro-life is that I guess I was always pro-life. I was a victim of sexual violence when I was a child, and that did not end when I became 12 and 13 years old. In fact, it continued into forced abortions. There were no pro-choice feminists coming forward to rescue me from the abuser. The Bloomington Planned Parenthood and other Planned Parenthoods have been exposed by Lila Rose doing undercover videos where she poses as a 13-year-old, even though she's about 20, 21, 22 when she does this. And people will dismiss that and say it's just a fabricated situation. It is not. There are many women who are post-abortive who were victims of sexual abuse and had forced abortions. When I was in college here at IU during the mid-80s, I noticed how it was just rabidly pro-abortion feminism on the campus. It was very depressing to me. I was repressing all my memories. When I ended up getting married and having children, I was living in Bloomington. The OBGYN group here would not do an ultrasound in the first 12 weeks. I searched the Monroe County Public Library. I searched every library branch at the IU campus and the main branch and the School of Medicine library. I could not find a photo in 88 and 89 of a preborn baby in the first trimester. And that disturbed me. Because at that point, I thought, well, you know, there may be cases where a woman should have a choice. And then I thought, wait a minute. This is supposed to be a feminist campus, and I can't see my baby in the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. Now, then years later, I went through the full-blown, I was going through the full-blown post-abortion syndrome raising my children. I couldn't even, I was a wreck. I could barely function. When I got my memory flooding, when I got to the point where I could get to recovery from abortion, I could not find help in your general clinical psychology field because a lot of these people did not feel comfortable. They were not taught or instructed at a university level how to deal with post-abortive women. This was in the 90s. Pro-life literally saved me, not just spiritually, but also physically and mentally. I am healthier now than I was in my teens or 20s. Pro-life to me is pro-woman, pro-women's health. Everything out there that is healing women, you go to the Washington, D.C. march in January every year on Roe v. Wade Day, the ranks are swelling of post-abortive women and men. There is a whole generation of people in their 20s that call themselves abortion survivors. They realize about a third of their generation has been lost to this eugenics, you know, decrease the population mentality. You know, what someone like Betty Cochran would regard as simply ideology opposing their cause, the ideology is post-abortion syndrome. America's suffering from it.
In what you were saying, Tom, and what you were saying, Marion, I want to ask you the question, when do you believe, and I know the answer, but just for our listeners, when do you believe the rights attached to this, to the conceived child?
When do I believe?
There's a right to be protected. I mean, you...
I obviously, during the moment of conception to natural death, and I want to stress that because it's more to me than just abortion, but from the moment of conception to natural death, a person should be protected.
I agree, and I agree because we're seeing that, I like to say that God's divine plan for perfection, for a utopia, can be revealed in the everyday logistics. They've dumped money for years into embryonic stem cell research. It has not produced results. Adult stem cell treatments are now treating 70 different diseases. And ironically, when my two little boys were born in 88, 89 at Bloomington Hospital, they were developing a brand new research into something called stem cells. And they asked, would you like to donate the umbilical cord and placenta? I said, yes. So I told my sons, now in their early 20s, I don't care what you say, you guys are pro-life.
But if Roe v. Wade in 1967 says that it's a woman's right to choose because it's her body that conceives the child or that bears the child, do you disagree with that, that it's not her right? Then whose right is it?
It's really, it was 1973.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's for your listeners. I would like to think it would be the father's choice too. Because there have been some isolated cases where the mother has selected to abort the child, and the father fought, but he doesn't have the right to take the child or have the child born.
I do believe in defending a woman's dignity. You could say that, you know, being a victim of sexual violence. Does a woman have a right to choose? A woman has the right to choose to protect her body from violence. Abortion is violence. I don't separate the violence against the unborn child from the violence against the woman. And the reason why is I went through the post-abortion syndrome. When you're 12 and a half and you're blocking out sexual abuse, and they take you to the family doctor or some doctor and say, you're going to have a pelvic exam. And they give you a shot in the stomach. And they strap you down, and your feet are in stirrups, and you don't know what's happening. And they put a tube into you. You feel excruciating pain. And then they wrap you up, send you out the door, and they say it's going to be like having a period. You don't know that you've been pregnant. How do you explain the nightmares about babies dying and being dismembered? How do you explain this? Nobody told me I was pregnant. I went through forced abortion, did not know what it was, and yet I was having a full-blown meltdown. The answer is a woman's body knows when life begins. A woman's body is building a baby, okay, from the beginning. So we have to respect the woman's body, and we have to respect the truth. And the truth is that if a woman chooses abortion, she's choosing to go against her own body's health.
Well, so do people who choose cigarettes, and so do people who choose alcohol, and so do people who choose to eat Coca-Cola and McDonald's and whatever, but we're not picketing them. We don't call that against life. I mean, there's people making bad decisions all the time. And I think President Obama might have said this. See, nobody wants to see people have abortions. People who are pro-life or pro-choice really don't want to see their daughters have abortions either. They don't feel that way.
I guess you could also ask somebody who has survived an abortion. There are people walking around this world who survive saline injection abortions. And theoretically, you can say, well, the first trimester, they don't survive it. But what if? Does the unborn baby have the right to choose? Is it a human life? I believe, yes, it is. And medical science is proving that there's no arbitrary beginning once it's in the womb. There's no arbitrary point where you can say, now it's a baby, but it wasn't before. No one would argue that what Dr. George Tiller or what Dr. Martin Haskell, who has a clinic in Indianapolis, would do in a late-term abortion in the last trimester. No one would argue with it, hey, you know, that is a baby, because it could live outside the womb. But, you know, there are people also who have to be on life support for a time in order to heal. So you could say their womb is the life support, but they could live once they're off of it. So, you know, then you're talking about personhood. And then it gets into kind of, that kind of argument can get very scary.
You know, one of the things that you and I talked about, Marion, was Betty Cochran had said that one of the characteristics of pro-choice people is that they don't really care about the women after whatever happens. They don't really care about the children after the children are born. In other words, pro-life people aren't adopting children. Yeah, they'll say to maybe a prospective mother, have the baby. You need to have the baby because we're pro-life, but we're not going to be there to support you. So if you're an at-risk girl or a girl who lives in poverty or a young lady who lives in poverty, and having the child would pose a difficult situation on you for the rest of your life, then that particular time, then the pro-life people just disappear. And there's no education, there's no help, there's no support. And I think this is one of Betty's positions that she talked about last week.
Okay. Very common argument. It holds no water because pro-life, from the late 70s and early 80s, they started something called the crisis pregnancy centers or pregnancy care centers. And they moved beyond that to actually caring for these women after the children were born. One of the things that I was taught when I was to go in front of a clinic is if you see a woman drive up and you see she's got a kid in the car, get down all the details. First baby saved, I saved. She had a three-year-old in the back seat and did not have a child car seat. When I called the Gabriel Project, and I'll tell you what the Gabriel Project is. When I called Gabriel Project, I said, oh, and she needs a child car seat for the three-year-old. The three-year-old's okay. The three-year-old's alive. But here, what the Gabriel Project is, and there are other organizations like this, it's a group of people. There's 40 churches involved. Anybody who wants to get involved can get involved. It serves English and Spanish-speaking communities. When a woman is in a crisis pregnancy, she often has a financial crisis, maybe bills that need to be paid. Maybe she's in a violent situation. Maybe she needs babysitting, rides to appointments, employment opportunities. Maybe she needs counseling, prenatal care, financial assistance, housing, education. Maybe she wants to look into adoption services. That's what Gabriel Project is about. That's what I actually work with if I were to do any kind of outreach in front of abortion clinics. And there are pregnancy centers that also go into that.
Now, do you go to the abortion clinic or the Planned Parenthood clinic here?
Yes, I do. Every Thursday, as long as I can, if I'm not working. And there are actually three other people that have shown up, married with kids, on different occasions, and they have actually said to women, I am willing to adopt your child.
Tom, do you go to the Bloomington Planned Parenthood clinic?
Actually, yes, I do. And the reason I do is we have a Planned Parenthood in Terre Haute. It's not a surgical center where they perform abortions, but they it's called a referral office, and they refer abortions down here. So I feel like I'm obligated to come down here and help my brothers and sisters in Bloomington to pray in front of it. And you've got to understand that we pray and fast not only for the baby, not only for the parents, but actually for the people that work inside the building too, because there's a book out right now called Unplanned by Abby Johnson, and it's a book. She ran a Planned Parenthood in Texas, and she was the director of this Planned Parenthood for many years in Texas, and she witnessed an abortion, and she'd realized some of the things she'd been telling her clients were lies. And so she...
For example?
It's only a tissue. It's not a baby until it's born. It will not feel pain. And what she witnessed was she had an abortionist come down, and he did an abortion with ultrasound, and she noticed as the instrument struck the baby started moving and trying to protect itself from the instrument. And that's when she knew everything she had been taught and trained to say was nothing but a lie.
Marianne, going back a little bit to what you were saying about the women, the families who are outside the Planned Parenthood clinic who would be willing to adopt children. It's interesting. I've talked to some people about the protesters who are out there, people praying, and peacefully so. And sometimes they put up signs that I think could be deemed as trying to sort of alarm or scare young women or say things that about don't have abortions. And going back to your question, I wonder why no one puts up a sign that says, if you have this child, I will adopt it.
Okay. Well, I guess I have seen a woman show up with her daughters. This was probably a year ago. And they did hold up signs, you know, that they were willing to adopt. And she was from another town farther away in Indiana. The woman that goes out there every Thursday with me, she is willing to adopt. I can make that suggestion to her. I can say, hey, why don't you hold up a sign? I think a lot of times people are disbelieving.
But I don't mean it as one example or here's an example. I mean just as a part of the pro-life voice. If the pro-life voice really said, you know, as a collective whole, we'll adopt your children, then in my particular opinion, I think it would be more, you know, more people would listen to pro-life.
I'm all for, I guess my big hero is Mother Teresa of Calcutta, and I would love to see pro-life. People don't like the idea of orphanages, but I would love to see more people willing to adopt. I personally cannot because I'm a single woman. I don't own a home.
Well, it's not about individuals. It's about a movement, and you're a part of the pro-life movement, and both of you are very interesting because you both have sort of different voices in this movement. And I think that our listeners, at least friends of mine who are listening, maybe think of pro-life people as having the same voice, the same personality. And the truth is, listening to both of you, there's two different voices.
There can be three or four different voices,
or maybe
too,
10.
Because some people are hung up on words.
Yes.
You know, they want to change laws. But if we go back and look at laws, there were laws against abortion, and there were still abortions happening. You know, and I remember learning this in one of my basic speech 101 college courses. I'm pretty old now, but I remember this one thing, and our professor would say, words have no meaning. People have meaning. Words are just symbols in which we communicate with. And I think that's so true that we cloud things with words, that our opinions, our mindsets, and everything go off in different directions. But one thing I'd like to add along this lines is post-abortive counseling or post-abortive. There's a lot of women that suffer, and the pro-life movement does take in those women and take them to retreats and really nurture them to get over their loss. Unfortunately, the pro-choice organizations don't do that. It's only the pro-life.
I did benefit a lot from the post-abortion healing of Rachel's Vineyard. There are a lot of women who are pro-choice who want to give counseling from a very pro-choice point of view. I read online, I try to dialogue with pro-choice women who are post-abortive. And just in my opinion, from what I've seen, I don't see the peace and the healing. I still see some kind of agitation and unrest with women who still feel mixed feelings about abortion, even though they've had one. I guess I just feel as though my healing came from accepting the fact that my life began at conception, that God is the one who created me, and you know, I surrender to a higher power.
We're coming to the end of this interview, and you know, it has been a pleasure having you here, and I hope that you will both come back for this to revisit this topic. But one last question, and I asked this question. This was the last question I asked Betty Cockrum, and it's fair to ask you. Many people think of this issue as black or white, but is there a middle ground? Is there a middle ground between the pro-life and the pro-choice people?
I always think there is. Nothing's impossible, and nothing's impossible with love. And of course, I'm going to, from my religious standpoint, I'm going to say the love of God. But I think when we start understanding, if we truly want peace in this world, we have to respect the life in the womb. Because if we don't respect the life of an innocent baby, we're not going to respect each other. And I do that when I vote. I figure if the politician doesn't care enough about the life of a baby, he's probably not going to really care about me, so why should I vote for him?
I will close with one quote, and it is from the author of the Equal Rights Amendment, Alice Paul. And she said, abortion is the ultimate exploitation of women.
Marion Leahy, Tom McBroom, thank you so much for coming to Interchange, and we hope you'll come back again.
Thank you.
In this next segment, reporter Aziza Stewart sits down with Bobby Booz for an interesting talk on CSA, or Community Sustainable Agriculture.
Hello, my name is Aziza Stewart, and today I'm joined by my guest, Bobby Booz. Bobby Booz is a local farmer and a crew leader and CSA coordinator for Life Certified Organic Farms here in Morgan and Monroe County. Bobby, welcome.
Thank you.
Could you please tell me a little bit about what CSA is and what you do with it?
CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, is a model that is used by a number of farms. It's a growing model around the country. And farms have various options to sell their food. Small sustainable farms tend to either go to farmers markets and directly sell to their customer. They may do wholesale for a small retailer like Blooming Foods or local restaurants, or they sometimes set up these CSAs. In a CSA, the farm has members who invest in the farm early in the spring and receive a weekly share of the food. So on our farm, on Thursdays, after we've harvested for the week, we fill up a box of food and deliver one to each of our 200 members.
So the CSA stands for Community Sustainable Agriculture?
Community Supported.
Community Supported Agriculture. And is this a new concept?
I have heard about CSAs for probably about 10 years. I don't know when they first originated as a model. Our farm has had a CSA for 3 years now, and each CSA works a little differently. So, you know, I can tell you about ours, but you might find as you talk to different farmers in the area that they set theirs up a little differently.
I would love if you told me about what your CSA was like.
Our CSA is 28 weeks long this year. Every year we extend the season a little bit. So we start in the spring toward the end of April. Like I said, we have 200 members. Our members get a various box of produce every week. They can pick it up in Bloomington or Indianapolis.
And how big are these boxes?
The boxes are, well, they vary in size. It depends. You know, sometimes in the spring there's a little less produce, so you might get maybe four different items. In the summer when it's really growing, you might get five or six more of them. So it sort of, it's not always consistent, but there's a definite a value over the whole season to participating in a CSA. We allow our members to choose full and half shares. And we say that a half share is good for a family of two, maybe, and a full share a family of four.
It's kind of like a cooperative, right?
It is like a cooperative.
So they pay for membership?
They pay seasonally, for membership. In the spring, you pay for that year's share of food.
And where does the money go to?
The money, it's really helpful that we get the money in the spring. You know, as opposed to selling at market where you get money when you sell it, we get money up front, which is allows us to, helps buy the seed and the soil amendments and the labor for starting and planting and getting it all going. So the CSA essentially, it goes to growing the food and all that entails.
Now, you said that the CSAs, there could be more than one. So for Life Certified Organic Farms, you're the coordinator for that CSA, right? And
right.
For other farms, there are other CSAs. So when you're working on one of these, now it's organic, do you use any kind of pesticides?
Well, being an organic farm doesn't mean you don't use, you definitely don't want bad pests. You know, you don't want weeds. So, you know, but we don't use synthetic chemical pesticides and herbicides. We look at a whole farm concept. And so we utilize a few different things. There are bacteria that will kill pests. And sometimes that's what you need to do. But it typically, even an organic certified pesticide kills all your insects. Whereas we look at, sometimes we have to do that, but we really focus on creating perimeters around our fields that have flowers and weeds that beneficial insects like. For instance, ladybugs eat aphids. So we create habitats that ladybugs like so that we can have ladybugs. We plant, for instance, around our greenhouses, it's hard to get pollinators inside a building, even when the doors are open. So we plant bright colored flowers around the perimeter that draws the bees closer, and then they're more likely to fly in the doors to pollinate those vegetables.
So what would a typical farm look like? Or what does the Life Certified Organic Farm look like? I'm very curious, because you said that you plant the plants that attract the ladybugs that eat the aphids. So would you have rows and then rows intersperse with that?
I think each farm actually sets up a little differently. I've seen a lot of different models. Now at Life Farm, we build roughly half acre, maybe acre fields. And then around those, we have access roads or trails maybe. And then perimeters that are anywhere from 20 to 50 feet that have various plants and habitats for insects and animals.
So that's quite large.
It is. We till about 10 acres.
So who are the people who run the show, basically, for Life Certified Organic Farms? Are you one of those?
Well, we have two owners, Art Sherwood and Jeff Evard. And Jeff Evard is our primary farmer. He is way knowledgeable about organic farming, and I have learned lots of stuff working there. And then we have a core crew, Grant and I, that return year after year. We've both been working for about 4 years now, and each year we have more seasonal workers who come in and are interested in learning about farming, and often they need a summer job but not a year-round job, and so they come on and really help us get everything planted and harvested. And
do you ever have college interns?
We haven't specifically had interns, but we definitely have some people who are college students come up because they'd like to learn. We did have one person who didn't work so closely in the harvesting and growing perspective, but came up to study insects and how pollinators worked on an organic farm.
So basically, the people who help you could be anybody, right? You don't need a special requirement?
They can be anybody. The special requirement is to enjoy hard labor, being outside, and to, you know, we obviously look for people who are fun and happy to work with because we spend a lot of time together.
Growing up, did you always want to be a farmer, or was this kind of a life shift over the years?
I did not always want to be a farmer. I remember when I was very young, I wanted to be a veterinarian, which I have not done. I did grow up in a rural community, but I did not really, was not interested in farming at all. Before I began vegetable farming, I did keep some chickens and some goats. But my enthusiasm for farming really came on a farm I worked on. I worked on for about 10 years that was just west of town, and I honestly started working on this farm because I could bring my daughter to work. And that was my priority at that time. But when I started farming and working in the soil and learning and watching her change and learn and, you know, her interests in food and how much more she wanted to eat, you know, I started to understand. And I started to become much healthier, and I realized the benefits of good exercise and good food, and, you know, had a desire to keep doing that and share it.
How much has farming changed your worldview?
I think farming for me has caused me to think much more locally. As I, you know, I look at farming and what I see is beneficial farming, you know, food that is actually healthful to people and healthful for the environment that can be sustainable is much more locally focused. Food is not a global commodity in my mind. And I think that, and sometimes to my detriment, I've become locally focused. I'm not as aware or involved in, you know, global situations. But I also believe that if we work in our local community and each local community builds, that we can network and support each other.
And that is one of the arguments against the whole Monsanto GE genetically modified food, which, by the way, do you think that that has a benefit in being able to mass produce tons of food that you get to a lot of people?
I don't think it has a long-term benefit. I think that's an argument that some people have. I think if we need to mass produce food on that scale to feed people, and I don't think that we do, I think that we are much more, it'd be much more efficient to produce it small scale locally, then if we are destroying our waterways, if we are having soil erosion, if we are, you know, degrading our farmland in ways that it cannot be used in the long term, we might be having a short-term Band-Aid solution, but that's going to catch up with us in a few years. And the damage it's causing, the cross-pollinating that's occurring, the older species of strong, hardy plants is getting, you know, sort of infected by Monsanto's GE foods, that we're causing, you know, damage that we won't be able to fix if it spreads too widely.
So Monsanto has these genetically modified seeds that farmers who produce vast majorities of soybeans or corn, for example, have to buy. So where do you buy your seeds from?
We buy our seeds from a number of suppliers. We have organic certified seeds. There are a number of them, and they tend to work with smaller farms. I mean, small farms is relative. So we source our seeds from places that are certified organic. We also save a lot of seeds. And so I think a lot of small farms are working now to build and have a larger seed bank.
We're almost out of time, but I have one more question. Is it more difficult to be a farmer these days than in times past? And can you make a decent living being a farmer?
I can't speak for being a farmer in times past. I think being a farmer, my guess would be that, like now, 2% of the population or less are farmers, you know, according to the census. I think before farming was a way of life. It was something you did. You got your food because you grew it. You might trade a little here and there, but most people grew their food. It was not so much an occupation as it is today. And yes, you can. And there are a few things that make that essential. I think being a farmer is not, you do not get a lot of dollars per hour, but you get a lot of food and fresh air and exercise. So you, I think the quality of life well makes up for the, you know, how much income you might be making. I also think that as more people are learning about the benefits of healthful food, they are willing to put more of their own efforts into it, maybe pay a little more, so that farming is becoming again, you know, for small farmers, people are understanding the value and starting to support small farmers again on a larger scale, which is allowing more people to have incomes as farmers.
Thank you so much. It was a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
You have probably heard of the Mayan prophecy, tentatively scheduled to come to fruition in 2012. Well, Dr. Irvin Laszlo joined Interchange to discuss the idea of quantum consciousness and the Mayan prophecy.
Dr. Laszlo, welcome to Interchange.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Dr. Laszlo, let's just jump into this subject. Can you give us an idea, what is quantum consciousness?
Well, there are many aspects to it. Quantum consciousness is a consciousness that communicated or conveyed by quantum processes in the brain. So I don't mean anything esoteric. I don't mean anything beyond science or you know, very much new age. I mean something quite concrete. It turns out that there are processes, there are substructures in the brain, and we are going into the details. There are microtubules and subarrays beyond the microtubules itself, which are very, very small. The individual units are 79 nanometers, so they are very minuscule indeed. And these sub-quanta are able to resonate with quantum waves or quantum processes that go on around the body, around and in the world at large. So as it were, these are antennas by which information can be picked up in the brain. And this information is usually picked up in the right hemisphere of the brain, and it comes in the form of intuitions and hunches. And very often in the modern world, at least in the Western world, we take these intuitions and hunches as mere fantasy illusion, and they are repressed. So we don't believe that they really exist, and we live as though they didn't exist. But yet they are an important connection for us individuals with the world around us, also with other people. So it would be very good to awaken to the fact that these quantum processes are actually taking place through quantum resonance. The technical term is phase conjugate quantum resonance. It means the phase of the waves that in the brain and the waves in the surrounding space that is reaching us are being conjugated. They get to the same phase, you know, they coincide in phase. So then information is transferred. So I don't want to get into technical details, but the point is that something that used to be thought of, something very esoteric, far out, just an extra non-sensory perception of our intuition of the world around us, actually, perhaps not all of it, but some of it certainly, has a veridical origin. We are actually connected to the world in more ways than through our eyes and our ears.
Well, I know that in reading the introduction to your new book, Simply Genius, in reading the introduction to that book, Deepak Chopra connects this idea of quantum consciousness and some of your other thoughts to the idea that we are actually connected, each of us, to each other, and that somehow we are becoming unconnected, and this disconnection is causing many of the world's problems today. Is that correct?
That's the crux of the matter. That's precisely the key to it. You know, we are connected, and all other species, in fact, I would say all humanity in its long, long history, has lived in view of these connections and be informed by these connections. In the context of the Western world in the last 100 years or so, let's say even since the dawn of the modern world, 300 years ago, we have believed that there is everything that comes to our consciousness, to our mind, must come through our eye and our ear and our other sensory organs. So nothing else can happen. And that means that our connections are limited to the world around us. You know, there's a beautiful saying by Einstein who said that we believe that we are only related to the world immediately around us, And this is a very much an impoverishing our mind, our consciousness, because it's a kind of a prison, our illusion, he said. This illusion is a prison, that's what he said, actually, that is limits us to the world immediately around us. Whereas, you know, we now realize that we are connected to a much broader sequence of things. We are really part of a whole web of life, and we can intuit, we can feel some of that. And if we don't, then we very often just act like we'll be separate and pursue our own interests at the expense of the others because we don't feel that we belong to it. We're no longer part of it.
Dr. Laszlo, in the United States, where we are very focused on individual rights, I think there's a general incredulity, a failure to believe that each of us can possibly be connected to each other. How can we overcome that?
Well, try to think of it. You know, we think that other animals, you know, are only getting information about through their own sensory organs, through their often quite limited eyesight or earsight. Some of them are more evolved, of course, than the humans, but very often they are more limited in the sensory organs. But, and then we say that the rest of their behavior is purely instinctive. We can't even explain how that happens. How is it that a spider, newly born, you know, can right away start weaving those intricate webs? They counted out that the information that you need to be able to do those, a web of that kind of a design is requires far more bits, many more bits, than there are neurons or our cells in the whole spider, you know, in the constitution of the spider. So this is just one example, but all of nature operates by means of these, guided, if you like, by these instinctive, intuitive connections. And great artists and poets, even great scientists, you know, Einstein himself is always saying that intuition is more important than reason. We all feel, we all can pick up these connections, but as I said, very sadly, we have decided that the world is sterilized, is not very fertile, because it has these little bits of movement of colors and sounds that immediately surround us. And that's only one aspect of the world. The world is much richer than that. The information that we get from the world is much more than that. All you have to do is try. Enter into a state of prayer, into a state of meditation, enter into a state where you are appreciating music or art or just nature, and you right away feel that how much coming to you, you know, into how much flows into your consciousness. Just have to allow it.
Doctor, when we look at the world today, or read the newspapers, look at the news, get news off of the internet, of course, we see many, many dangerous trends. And I believe, many of us believe that if changes aren't made, critical things may happen to us collectively as human beings. Could you speak to any warnings or anything that you may see in the future?
Well, nowadays the word crisis is becoming very familiar because we have on different kinds of crisis, whether it's financial crisis or a nuclear meltdown or economic crisis or exchange rates or population crisis or sicknesses spreading. You know, there's a various kinds of crisis. Now, these are all a kind of tipping point. They are all when you reach a process that has reached that has got to a point where it cannot go on as it did. It's got to change because it becomes unstable. And the aspects of a critical point, it's known in science as a bifurcation, or it can be called a critical bifurcation. And that means that the system has a choice. It either changes or it breaks down. If it's not to break down, it's got to change. The one thing that it doesn't go at this point, at the crisis point, is what is known as the BAU scenario, the BAU scenario, which means business as usual. In other words, if you ignore it and you keep doing things the way you have been doing it, then the crisis is likely to get worse, or you get into a whole series of crises and you can't, eventually won't be able to pull out of it. So at this point, we need to recognize the need for change, for transformation. And if you do that, then you can ask naturally, okay, what is it that we can do? What alternatives, ways that we can act? What else can we do than what we are doing? Then the opportunity arises, really. At that point emerges the opportunity to innovate, to be creative, and to do something which we will not be able to do before because the system wouldn't allow us. When a system becomes unstable, it becomes sensitive to change. I think that's a great lesson that we get from so-called chaos theory and complex system theory. Unstable systems are very open to change, and our systems are becoming unstable in the worldwide, whether it's economic or political or social or ecological or financial systems, and therefore they are more sensitive, more open to change.
So in your opinion, we are, as a race, at the critical bifurcation point?
We are at a race with these natural processes that are moving toward the bifurcation point, yes. Either we anticipate and use the opportunity when the critical point is reached to consciously and willfully, rationally move forward in a positive direction, or we don't know what's going to happen then. We got a chaotic situation which will be basically beyond our control.
Dr. Laszlo, around the United States, there's been talk for some months now about the Mayan calendar, the 2012 prophecy. According to what some of the things that you have written and some of the things that other interviews I've seen with you, your view is that at that time there will also be a shift in human consciousness, a macro shift. Can you talk about that, please?
Well, if there is a widespread belief that the time for change has come, and there is some physical evidence that things are not the way they are, you know, even right now when you have a serious change in the weather, unusual weather patterns which you're having increasingly, people changing, oh yeah, things are not the same as they were. You know, like the old saying is, the future is not what it used to be. So at that point, you see, the world opens up to a shift. And by shift, I mean then at that point people will ask, shall we go on or can we go on the way we have been? And when you ask this question, then, of course, all the alternative possibilities open. Then you find the way to do things, because there are so many other things we could do. We can shift. We can use money in quite different ways. You know, we're using money for two primary purposes. One, to get rich. Those people who have the money, they want to get richer, and they use the money to accumulate their own wealth. And we are using money to basically aggressive purposes, which is called national defense very often, but often they are really just to try to be more powerful than any possible enemy or alternative system in the world could be. So if we could use only a significant portion of just this money to use it for human purposes, we could eradicate poverty, we could vanquish diseases, we could create a wellness and a decent standard of life for all the hundreds of millions who are right now at the very edge of survival, and for poverty, even in rich countries, as in the U.S., that still exists and it's actually growing. And then we could create more sustainable ways of living, better technologies, using our technologies to sustain the processes, sustain our access to resources, make use of energies that are coming to us. For example, these flow energies from the sun, which are almost infinite as far as practical purposes are concerned, instead of using either the finite fossil energies, which are polluting, or using nuclear energies, which can be very dangerous. All of these are things that should make us think, that way that we have organized our technology, the way we are using money, the way we are using power, is not sustainable. You've got to change it to make it so that everybody can participate, so that we can sustain our access to resources, access to life on Earth. We have the technology, we have the money, we have the energy. What we need is the will and the understanding that we have got to start using it in a more rational, in a more systematic way.
If you look ahead, do you think that we're going to be able to find it in a more useful and rational way? Do you think that human beings will be able to accomplish this, what we need to do to survive and to ride out this macro shift?
In principle, yes. When we actually do it, you know, I think there is no real forecast possible. But the point is, the future is not to be forecast, it's to be created. It's up to us to do it. We can do it. And I have a hunch, sort of, that, you know, our power as a species has something like a collective survival instinct. And when we are threatened in our very survival as a species by forces that are beyond our control, and some of the forces that we ourselves liberate, some are independent, of course. But when that happens, then our joint instincts, our collective survival instincts, get activated, and we become more conscious, become more capable, more able to cooperate and to live and to work together. This is what happens very often in war times, you know. When people are threatened, then all of a sudden a sense of cooperation arises. I lived through that at the end of Second World War in my native country, Hungary, where people could join together when there was the Nazi invasion, and they pulled together, and nobody is just thinking of his or her own immediate good, but they're thinking what we can do together. Then you have an emergency. People also have this sense not only of pulling apart everybody rushing to the exit for his or her own way, but also, and more importantly, to join together and say, okay, what can we do now? And I think this is the kind of activation of our joint survival instincts, which is going to pull us through, and we are going to be able to create a world that is peaceful and sustainable. Because let me repeat, we can do it. Everything is there for us to do it. We just need to join together to start taking those steps that will bring us to it.
We've been speaking to Dr. Irvin Laszlo, who is coming out with a new book that's going to be released very soon, Simply Genius. Dr. Laszlo, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. It's been great having you with us.
William, it's very good talking with you. Thank you.
In our last segment, The Last Minute, commentator Roosevelt Faulkner offers his thoughts about the 100th anniversary of the Greek organization Kappa Alpha Psi.
If you were walking downtown on Kirkwood or passing through Dunmeadow by the River Jordan, you would have noticed a large gathering of men of all ages, particularly African-American men, snapping pictures, setting their feet in the River Jordan, singing songs and chants, and posing with their distinctive hand symbol, all while donning Indiana crimson and cream with the Greek letters Kappa Alpha Psi on their apparel, showing pride, humility, and confidence. You may have been wondering why all these men have convened in Bloomington in the middle of summer. They came to celebrate a milestone event, the 100th year of the fraternity's existence. Kappa Alpha Psi, a Black Greek fraternity, was founded on January 5th, 1911 by 10 African-American IU students. At that time, of course, there was a minimum African-American presence on the IU campus, and Jim Crow was alive and well. These 10 young men felt the need to start an organization that would offer them support, encouragement, and lasting friendship. Now the organization has grown to having thousands of members. Black Greek life has become an integral part of historically Black colleges across the country. At times when Blacks found very little, if any, help from most American institutions, it was the Black Greek organizations, as well as churches, that helped lay the foundation for Black participation in the American dream. And last week reminded me that this particular organization started right here in Bloomington 100 years ago.
Thanks for listening to Interchange. We hope you enjoyed the new format. If you have an idea or a story idea, or you want to be on The Last Minute, please write us at interchange@wfhb.org. That's interchange@wfhb.org. Your comments are appreciated. Thanks to our assistant producer, Shang Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris. The executive producer is January Jones. Original theme music by Jamil Effiam. Additional music by Ramsey Lewis and Billy Taylor. Stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman, coming up next on your community radio station, WFHB. I'm Ashley Beeman. Thanks for listening.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.